Okay. We'll now commence with our meeting. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are unfortunately pressed with time today because we have a meeting exactly at 12 o'clock following this one. And we would have loved to engage with the Competition Commission more, especially on this particular issue in this time, difficult time. Can we immediately then, without a waste of time, welcome everyone here, who's here, including the media, all members here, and appreciate the coming in of the Competition Commission. And we hope that next time we'll make sure that you are here on time. Can we, without a waste of time, just get quickly a recall, apologies?
Yeah, only a... Thank you, Chair. The only apology that I received was from Mrs. Lyon, Chair, Honorable Lyon.
Okay, so we take others as absent. With Mrs. Lyon, I guess we are in order with Ms. Lyon's apology. Can we then give you, members, you'll understand that we are overseeing the implementation of the framework agreement, and one of the role players there who must ensure that that framework agreement is implemented in total is the Competition Commission, and they have areas of focus, of course, that they need to ensure that they meet actually within a particular time frame. And today they will be briefing us on as to how far have they gone in implementing some of those agreements to ensure that there is fair competition and everybody within this open market system plays his or her role in a fair manner. Can we then allow them to brief us on their findings into some of the areas that they targeted? We are today going to be focusing precisely on the food and agro-processing area. Without a waste of time, can we hand over to Mr. Ramboro? Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I apologize once again for being late. I do have a lot of slides, so I'm going to go through them, and I thought I had much longer than half an hour, so I'll go through them very quickly. That's just what constituted in this talk. I should say that your reference to the framework agreements, while a lot of our work is included in those, a lot of our work began way before that agreement came into place, and a lot of it was then included in the agreement as things we would in particular pursue. Just some background into the food and agro-processing markets in South Africa. You'll all recall that there was a time, and not too long ago, before 1996, where agricultural markets were regulated in this country through agricultural marketing boards. There used to be boards for wheat boards, banana boards, you know, every kind of agricultural product you could think of that we were producing. And there were lots of cooperatives in the manner in which farmers were operating at the time. Liberalization came to these markets in 1996. This included tariff reforms, where tariffs came down, and a lot of these were spurred by trade agreements, in particular the SAEU trade agreement and some of our WTO negotiations. The effects of liberalization since after 1996 then were the closing down of these boards. Market concentration tended to continue to exist in a number of these markets, and dominant private firms replaced the cooperatives that previously existed. We've also seen a surge in imports in processed food, tinned food, and other food. And the SAFEX, which was established in the Johannesburg Stock Exchange in order to trade some of these food commodities. What effectively happened in this post-1996 period is cartels replaced public regulation. So whereas previously things were regulated by government structures regulating production and prices, these now were kind of privately regulated in a sense by cartels, and I will speak a little bit about that later. Now, I think the point to make, because this is what kind of spurs a lot of interest in food markets, is the high price of food in the recent past. In the last 2 years ago, we've seen kind of dramatic increases in food prices, not only in South Africa, but internationally. And there are, in fact, a whole range of reasons for this. One cannot kind of pin down a causality to one factor. There's multiple factors leading to high food prices. Amongst them, the availability of grains worldwide. There's meant to be an increase internationally in the demand for grain. High population growth in China and India, for example, are cited as reasons for that. And then there's increasing demand not only from kind of economic growth generally in the recent past, but because food production is now competing with the biofuels industry, where a lot of grain is being used to produce fuel rather than to feed people. Food production also is affected by a whole range of other conditions, like climatic conditions, and also the cost to food production has increased in this period. There's been higher energy and fuel costs leading to higher transport costs, and this has been passed on to consumers in the end. But certainly, amongst all the factors that result in higher food prices is the fact that anti-competitive conduct in the agro-food industry pushes up these prices. And this is not only amongst the producers of food, but amongst the people, those sectors that make inputs into food production. We mentioned fuel earlier, but we'll see as we go along. Now, the structure of food markets in South Africa is interesting. I think a lot of it has depended on the history around, previous co-ops and the way people operated and then the liberalization. But historically, we've got a number of oligopolies at a few players in a market and virtual monopolies at a regional level, and you'll see this, for example, in grain storage. We've also seen in these markets increasing vertical integration, that is, firms integrate or merge with other firms that are making inputs into their production, and horizontal concentration. These are firms that are competitors with each other. There's a high level of concentration at that level. So what we've seen is limited new entrants into these markets due to barriers such as access to capital, and new entrants would have to compete against very established brands which have a foothold in the market already. We've seen transformation at the level of ownership in a number of these established firms, but incumbent firms continue to leverage historical positions to extract profits and impose standards around the production of food, standards which a new entrant might not be able to necessarily meet very quickly. The interventions of the Competition Commission has been firstly made, our interventions are limited to what the Competition Act allows us to do. We're not a kind of agency that has been set up specifically to deal with any particular market. It's not like we are specifically set up to deal with food markets, but our act allows us to deal with all kinds of anti-competitive behavior, and we must confine ourselves to dealing with those behaviors. We are in kind of legal jargon, a statute of a creature of statute. We can only do what the law allows us to do. We can't do anything beyond that. This is an important point when I find, because people are often, with the successes that the Competition Commission have had, are asking us to do more and more things. Some of these things are not necessarily things that we can even do because the law doesn't allow us to do that. But essentially what we do is we enforce, we have an enforcement side of the organization, which we're seeing a lot of work around recently. We also can exempt certain behaviors that might be anti-competitive, but if there's good reason for them to continue, people will make a case before us and we'll exempt those behaviors. And then we have to approve mergers, which you can imagine would lead to higher levels of concentration going forward if they are made in markets with a small number of players. And then we do a lot of advocacy work, which is trying to kind of change behavior without enforcement, without the stick, trying to persuade people to do the right thing. So we work a lot with industry associations, for example, and the business constituency to encourage and persuade them that, you know, they should act in a pro-competitive way. And then there's a lot of market inquiries that we will do in the future. The significant one we've done up to now is a banking inquiry. Now, one of the areas of work that we've prioritized in the Competition Commission is the food value chain. We went through a major prioritization process about 3 years ago, and we kind of examined this this year again, and we set out a number of criteria by which we would prioritize our work. An agency like ours with limited resources can't do everything. We've got to decide what are the most important things to do and then kind of try to make a success of that. And the reason we prioritized the food value chain is for a number of very kind of obvious reasons. Firstly, food has an impact on all consumers, and in particular low-income consumers, who pay a much higher percentage of their spend a much higher percentage of their disposable income on food as opposed to other classes, if you like, in society. We've also historically received a number of complaints around anti-competitive behavior in the food sector. We've seen a number of government interventions in the recent past. About 3, 4, 5 years ago, there was a task team set up to monitor prices. We've seen a lot of talk around dealing with food markets through industrial policy interventions. We ourselves did some research around all of the different food markets, what we call scoping exercises, just to have an initial look at it. And our research also showed strong indications of anti-competitive conduct. I'm now going to speak about the major cases we've dealt with. And you'll see, I'll go through these one by one, and you'll see that we have cases around different food products themselves, and inputs into food production. And these are different levels depending on the case of the value chain. To start off with, fertilizer is, you'd all appreciate, one of the major inputs into farming. And we found that there were high levels of concentration in these markets, in the fertilizer market. Fertilizer is the single largest input cost in production of crops such as maize and wheat, for example. And there's been a long-running cartel for years and years in the production of fertilizer. One of the fertilizer firms in this cartel, Fosco, applied for corporate leniency at the commission. This is a facility we have where the first firm that tells us about a cartel gets indemnity from prosecution. And Sasol subsequently reached a settlement with the commission with a penalty of 250 million rand. This occurred in the current financial year. The case against the remaining members of the cartel, Omnia and Kinnock, is continuing, and we find this is and in addition to the cartel case, there are local monopolies in the main inputs to fertilizer. The main inputs to fertilizer are ammonia and phosphate rock. And in the case of ammonia, we find that Sasol is charging an import parity price for its ammonia. And in the phosphate rock matter, which is not on the slide, the company concerned, Foscor, is settling with us. Then another input into food production is tin plate. Tin plate is what one uses to make cans for canned food. And we found that, you know, tin plate pricing impacts very heavily on the local production by farmers. Example, in tin tomatoes competing with imports, we're seeing more and more imports of tin tomatoes, for example, and canned fruit for export purposes. And and the high price of tin plate is ultimately passed on to the consumer who buys these food. The sole local producer, ArcelorMittal, has increased tin plate prices by around 70% in April this year, and a commission investigation is underway. We also have other cases in relating to other inputs to agricultural production, namely diesel. We're looking at that in a separate case altogether. Fencing wire, we have a case around this. You can imagine that fencing wire is important for farming purposes, all sorts of things they do in farming. And plastic irrigation pipes, which is not on the slide, but in the thing, plastic irrigation pipes, which are used for irrigation purposes in farming. And we're dealing with a case around on a cartel in that market. Then there's been our bread and milling case. This is a case that was, you know, I think a case that got a lot of publicity, a lot of media attention. The Competition Commission initiated this case after receiving a complaint. The four big bakeries in South Africa have been involved in this cartel where they were fixing prices and allocating markets. There were two cases here, one relating specifically to behavior in the Western Cape and another around the national cartel. The progress in this case, I think people might be familiar with. Premier Foods, who makes the Blue Ribbon product, applied for leniency of the commission, so they were not prosecuted. Tiger was given a penalty of 98.8 million rand in a settlement. Food Corp also settled with us with a penalty of 45.4 million, and the remaining member of the cartel, Pioneer, has defended the case. Closing arguments were heard in September this year already, and we're waiting the outcome. In their defense, they didn't kind of deny the existence of a cartel. Their quibble with us essentially was whether they were involved in the national cartel. They were saying, yes, we were involved in the Western Cape, but we were not involved nationally, so you can't slap a fine on us that takes into account our national turnover. And that is essentially what that case rests on. But with the kind of evidence we have from the remaining members of the cartel, we felt quite confident in pursuing that case. We've also seen that, and I'll show you a slide on this, research findings that margins increased at processing and retail of milled products, and we've initiated case investigations here in the milling of wheat and maize as well, which are at other levels of this value chain. We've got leniency applications also in those milling cases, and investigations in these cases are currently being concluded. This is just a picture showing the markup of bread over wheat. So the price of the wheat price is in the black dotted line. And one of them, the top one is the flour, and the bottom one is the wheat. And then the blue line looks at the cost of bread, and the difference between the wheat and the bread price is in the bars. Okay, the blue bars, and we see over time that is increasing. Okay. Then at another level of that very same value chain, grain storage and trading is something we looked at. We received a complaint by a trader against Senves, who owns the silos which store the grain, and the allegation there is that they've abused their dominance in the storage and handling of grain, linked to their kind of almost monopoly positions of the privatized co-op. So in the olden days, these silos were run cooperatively, and now we're just handed over to Senves, who kind of has a monopoly now over this area. This matter has been heard. The tribunal found, the competition tribunal found, that there was exclusionary conduct related to independent traders of grain, but the tribunal decision is being appealed at the Competition Appeal Court, and we're currently awaiting a decision of the Competition Appeal Court on this matter. We have other cases in grain storage under investigation. This relates to the setting of storage price for futures contracts in the Industry Association, and we have a case against Rand Merchant Bank and Northwest Corporasi for alleged market allocation and price fixing. Okay, then there's our dairy case. Now, the Commission referred a complaint in this matter in December 2006. That's quite a long time ago. This was about collusion and the abuse of dominance by processors. So here you have, you know, if you think of the three levels, the producers of milk are the farmers, the processors are the people who put it into bottles and sell it, and then the retailers on sell it to the end consumer. And this was also a very heavily regulated market previously, and we finding that a lot of the same phenomenon is occurring, where private parties are now privately regulating these markets by colluding amongst themselves. They're able to both suppress the raw milk prices, the prices they pay to the farmer, and raise barriers to entry at that level through exclusive arrangements. So they say to a farmer, you can only sell to me, you can't sell to anybody else. That's our agreement. If you're selling to anybody else, I'm not going to buy from you, kind of thing, right? And this case is currently very tied up in a number of legal processes. Very recently, I gave a report back to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and kind of, in fact, it was a presentation of our annual report, and I had to explain in the context of our annual report what our major costs in the organization were. And one of our major costs is litigation fees, what we pay lawyers to fight all these cases. And the more interlocutory litigation we have, you know, like we have in the dairy case, where people are not kind of, we're not getting to the merits of the matter, but we're taking technical points, the higher our bills are, our legal bills are. And in explaining this to the Trade and Industry Committee, I got two nasty letters from two respondents in this dairy case, Clover being one of them, kind of suggesting that I shouldn't be speaking at all about this case because it is still under, you know, it's still being heard by the courts. But the kinds of, especially since in one of the matters, Clover actually partially won part of the court case that they were dealing with. There were two rounds of this going into interlocutory matters. The first related to the parties kind of saying that we were out of time in referring the matter to the tribunal because our clocks, we've got a limited amount of time to investigate a case and then pass it on for adjudication. And they started our clock running at a time that some arbitrary individual from the public made a call to a very low official, you know, at the commission. It wasn't a formal application, and they were suggesting that that's when our clock started running. And this was kind of thrown out both by the tribunal and the Competition Appeal Court. And then the second matter, which is, and that kind of went from the appeal, from the tribunal to the appeal court, it came back then to be heard again. They raised another matter, this time Clover and another firm, and this related to how we constructed our summons. They were saying that our summons were not summons to summons. Information from these parties were not properly constituted, and they challenged that. And they won aspects of that in the court, but not all of it. So they're feeling that I shouldn't be talking about this because they've now taken that matter to the Supreme Court of Appeal to be heard there as well. Okay, then the other food market we're dealing with is poultry. Poultry is the main, chicken is the main source of protein for the majority of South Africans. The Commission referred a case against Astral and Elite in 2008. This is an abuse of dominance case in breeding by engaging in exclusionary conduct. We embarked on this case following extensive background research. We looked, investigated different levels of the market, including animal feed, breeding stock, broiler production, and poultry products. Excuse me. Then the other major, the other case that we're looking at in the food markets is relating to pelagic fish. Historically, once again, this was a single marketing challenge, channel rather, in the 1990s, known as Federal Marine. Deregulation led to competitors allocating brands through an auction amongst themselves. And our initiation into pelagic fish is at different levels of the market, the fishing level, the processing level, and the retail level. The key concerns here include exclusive agreements and alleged collusion between the firms involved in the production of fish. We also investigation in an allegation of an export cartel in the Hague market. Then we have an investigation into edible fats and oils. We've initiated an investigation against Unilever, which is the major producer of margarine, and 14 others. This followed the retail price of cooking oil increasing by 116% between 2006 and 2008. And the allegation is that there's collusion in the vegetable oil market. In the case of Unilever, the allegation there is that Unilever is abusing its dominant position in margarine. Okay, and then at a completely other level of the value chain, an important level because this is where consumers, this is the point at which consumers have to pay the price, as it were, at the supermarkets. We initiated what amounts, I think, more to an inquiry into the supermarket sector, where we're looking at a number of things. This kind of followed public outcry about high food prices, and we also received a complaint from the milk producers organization suggesting that it was at the supermarket level that, for example, milk prices, the margin was raised. At the detriment of consumers. And we did a preliminary study before we initiated the complaint, which was against all the major retail stores, including Pick and Pay, ShopRite, Checkers, and Spar. And what we're looking at here, this is still early days of this investigation, is firstly buyer power, the fact that supermarkets buy such large quantities and then have the ability to provide rebates in not a very transparent way to the manufacturers and suppliers of food products to them. Secondly, we're looking at the long-term lease agreements that some of these supermarkets have with the malls and shopping centers that they're located in. So, for example, if Pick and Pay has a lease of space in a particular shopping mall, part of the agreement with the owners of that mall is no other supermarket can operate there, or not even a little grocery store or a little fruit and veg store. So if you go to a number of malls, you'll see that there's only one major kind of retailer. They wouldn't even allow like a little kind of grocery store or a little fruit and veg shop in that mall. That's the terms in which they get they make their agreements. And these are very long term, and of course they raise barriers to entry into these markets. And then, thirdly, we're looking at a phenomenon known as category management. Category management is where a supermarket will ask for all the producers of a particular product, all the suppliers of a particular product, to get together under the leadership of one of them to decide amongst themselves where their products will be placed on the shelves in the supermarket. This is a very big issue because where your product is placed on the shelves determines how fast it's sold, and how many of your products is placed is also important because, you know, you want to kind of move things in a supermarket at a particular rate. And the allegation there is that this practice may facilitate collusion amongst the producers themselves. And then fourthly, we're looking at information exchange and how some of these market intelligence consultants who collect all this information from the different players in a market might be involved in sharing this information amongst the different players, thereby facilitating collusion. Okay, this is an important slide because, and it's my last but one slide. There's two more slides after this. Because what it shows is that it's a summary of everything we're doing, and what it shows is on your top-down axis, your vertical axis, it shows that we're kind of looking at cases at different levels of the value chain. The number of things relating to input costs in the cost of the production of food, both in the actual production, the storage, the processing of food, and the retailing of food. So we have cases in these different levels, in different products, and it also tells you where we're at, where the most of the cases you'll see are still early days in an investigation phase. We're still investigating these matters. Now, you know, we can't always guarantee that an investigation will produce an outcome that says there's something wrong. We've got to meet certain legal standards in making our case. And so a lot of energy goes into investigating a case properly. A number of cases are at the hearing stage, where that's when we complete our investigation and pass a case on to the tribunal for adjudication. We settled a few very important cases. Fertilizer, that was the 250 million rand fine to Sasol. Bread, you're familiar with, we settled with most of them. And then in grain, we've got a decision, but that's been taken on appeal. And a number of both grain and dairy are kind of stuck in appeal processes right now. So, I mean, the idea for us is to move all of these cases now to the right. Of course, not the last one. Appeals and reviews take us all the way back to the beginning, so that's not very useful, but to take them to conclusion. I think it's important to say that in terms of the Commission's work, we find that high concentration levels in our economy still prevails. There are still considerable barriers to entry for new players to enter a number of these markets, and there are very poor competitive outcomes in a number of these markets. We don't see prices falling. We don't see high levels of competition that will push prices down. And what we need to do, I think, as the Commission, as our mandate requires us, is to undermine cartels, is to create opportunities for new firms to enter these markets. In particular, we need to examine the role of industry associations, which historically and we suspect currently are facilitating collusive behavior between players in a market. And importantly, we need to increase agricultural production for a whole range of other reasons, food security reasons, for example, by addressing the effects of anti-competitive conduct on costs. We also need to improve an understanding across government and relevant public institutions around how these markets work and what the issues are in them. And I think if there's one thing that we do, if nothing else, is we generate a lot of very, very valuable information around how these markets work that are that will be useful to other government departments and policymakers. Important then, my final slide, is to look at what the role of the state here should be in general. I think it's important to remember that the Commission's investigations uncover conduct that has occurred in the past, you know, something that's already happened, and we're looking at the consequences of that right now. That's what we're able to do. But what needs to happen also is we need proactive measures to increase competition and change outcomes going forward. So we can punish or we can find somebody who's done something bad, in inverted commas, in the past, but there needs to be greater efforts around kind of increasing competition going forward. And this requires a fair amount of coordination on the part of government and public institutions. I think this is not something that only the competition authorities do. There's a whole range of others, and some of these I've listed here, and of course this is not a kind of limited list. But certainly we need development finance to support new entry into some of these markets where appropriate. We need, very importantly in my view, to leverage government shareholding and support to encourage competitive conduct. A number of these firms, some of these firms involved in this kind of behavior, you know, Sasol, for example, have government as their shareholders, and government in their capacity as shareholders need to be putting the pressure on these firms to behave in particular ways. We also need supportive government interventions in economic infrastructure, research and development, and skills development. These are all projects on the go at various levels by government, which you'll be aware of, but that's important in our view in kind of creating higher levels of competition in some of these markets. And of course, government can use its procurement processes to support new entry and use trade and industry policy and regulation to also get particular outcomes. Thank you very much. I'll leave it at that and see if you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
So if I can just introduce the two people that come with Simon Roberts on my left is our chief economist. And maybe if you can just come here. And of course, Ivona Kele is our deputy commissioner of the Competition Commission.
Can you repeat his name again? Ivona Kele. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ramburu, for the presentation. Can we now maybe to clarify one issue, because you see what you said about companies not wanting you to speak about the progress in terms of the cases before you, especially when briefing the parliamentary committees. I think it's becoming a trend now. From one of our meetings also, we heard from one agent that some companies are not comfortable with their information being released. And I think this is something that we'll have to talk about, because we are governed by the Constitution and also the rules and procedures as portfolio committees. And in as far as that is concerned, we would like to be as transparent as possible, hence you see the media here. And companies must also conduct themselves properly if they really don't want their matters to be deliberated upon. in a negative way if they feel so, that it is in a negative way. But in as far as the work of the committee, we will demand as much information as possible, and I think we are protected by the Constitution to get that kind of information, unless otherwise, you know, barred by the court that is that has authority over the Constitution, or that is tasked with the responsibility of interpreting the Constitution. I will now open for questions, for clarity, comments from members. Member Mabasa, Member Ntuli, Member Dr. Huang, Dr. Rabi. In that order, please.
Thank you, Comrade Chair, and thanks for the presentation. My question is, what mechanisms does the Commission have to arm citizens such that citizens are aware of the value of the Competition Commission? Because you know, if that value is not appreciated, it means that the potential of utilizing the public could be, may not be optimized. But also the second point is the where companies have been found guilty, is the punishment enough to discourage that risk taking? Because if it's very minimal, it will be a question of weighing what is of more benefit to that company. Thanks, Encourage.
Thank you. And you'll note, and then afterwards respond. Member Ntula.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I would like to concur with you about the rules of Parliament. I think that they are protected by the rules of Parliament, that whatever you say here, you cannot be prosecuted outside to say that what we have been saying in Parliament. Chair, I just want to check the intervention of the state. What can be done? I'm looking at the impact of those farmers who decided to change these agri farms to be wild animal keeping, because some of them, you find that they were running from when there's this land expropriation, then they started to not plow anything. They just look for the animals to keep them there. And particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, it's a huge, huge land where you find that it's no longer used, but they keep white animals, and there is no production of vegetables. I just want to check what can be done by the state, because you can see that there is a trend to move that direction, that instead of plowing vegetables, we just put animals there, and it's at no cost. You just keep that place and you don't sell it, but it's there unused just by these animals. I just want to find out your take there. What can be done to try to cap that? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Member Julie. Dr. Ma?
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I also appreciate for the Commission for this presentation. I want to agree for the Chairperson you say for this major case. Yeah. All this list must be transparent to our committee. We need all the information. because these older, these big companies, they all the monopoly for the oil marketing in South Africa. Even like your presentation say, this small farm is all under control by this big company. They can't sign any other agreement with the other separate one. So they already is occupied all the market. So I think this one, from the your presentation, you say your commission is haven't got the big power. You only have the limit the power to investigation. For your last presentation, for last I think page 9. For all of these company, just my colleague say, if you take the penalty, like the SASO, you say 200 million, other company 45 million. But if you look in the turnover, this 45 million, 200 million is a small peanut. Even you take this the penalty, we just show to the public and say, you got the discipline, but nothing for the beneficial to the other consumer. So my deep concern is from the commission, your organization, how you can have the enough power, got control for this, all the this high price for the food, and all the protect this normal consumer. Thank you.
Thank you,
Dr. Ravi. Thank you, Chair. My question, Mr. Amrit Rudl, relates to fish. In my constituency, I have a number of fishing communities, and in the past, hake was a staple food to them. But what happens, and other species of fish, I realize that the more expensive species of fish, like, for example, king clipper, but even today, hake has been exported to Spain, and the exporters tell me that the reason for why they're exporting these species of fish is for the simple reason that they get double the amount of money that they get on the domestic market. But surely, Madam Chair, I think it's important. I know we earn a degree of foreign revenue, but it's also important to retain some of the fish stock for our own people in this country here, seen in the light of tourism, the World Cup, and so forth. Because at the moment, I believe that the major proportion of king clip and hake has been exported to overseas. I'd like to have his views on that too, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the issue is about the capacity of the competition board. And because it's clear that there is so much when I look at these cases. Are you in a position to really and handle and this amount of work? And to the benefit of the expectations and by the South African public. And perhaps the next one is on the impact of this kind of irregularity that you are uncovering. And to, if you take, for instance, food security, and how much impact does it have in increasing poverty levels in South Africa? Because if you up the price, and obviously there's a very big percentage of the people that are cut out, and from you, in other words, there will be no access of food. How much does it impact on that? Is there a study that has been done? And and also linked to that, is there any thinking about the involvement of the subsistence farmers in this whole process, so that by encouraging subsistence farmers to participate, and you are somehow mitigating on the shortage of food? And the question of the liberalization, the whole liberalization that took place in 1996, as you say, which seems to have been the opening of the floodgates for this kind of truancy to happen. And is there any thinking and of somehow ensuring that there is a decisive state intervention in favor of the people, because it may be that the boards were not bad entirely. The regulations that were there before were not bad entirely. And if liberalization within the context of the global situation have actually led to this kind of situation, and is there any thinking of actually and putting up structures that and become nuts and bolts of in favor of the ordinary people? And the last one is the penalty. The penalty, and I agree in my own assessment and with the my colleagues, it does to me, and it's obvious. I mean, it's conditioning in psychology. And when you hit something, you just condition it. And they actually remain there because they believe that the punishment that you are actually hitting does not have any impact. And they get conditioned to it, but they continue. It does not change the behavior. And that's the point, really, that I want to. And how much deterrent does it actually offer to them? Because I believe that, for instance, one of the proposals, Chair, would be a capped price for a certain, an imposed capped price for a certain and a period of time, even if it said that, okay, this penalty, 9.8 million, but your price will remain at this level for 5 years. And then after 5 years, you can start to actually loosen up. And basically, those are the questions.
Thanks, Sangonyam. Can I add mine, or will you respond, and then I'll come after? But it's just, I think it's a follow-up also on some of the issues, of the questions raised. You see, I'm also worried, much worried with what the Mr. Ngonyama has just said, of course, following from what Dr. Huang was saying. I sometimes don't understand the intended objective of, you know, some of these investigations. When you look at the type of penalties that you come to at the end, you do reach some settlements, and sometimes my belief or my understanding of, you know, reaching of settlements is because there's somewhere where perhaps you find that somebody made a mistake in the process and you are able then to settle. In that case, who suffers at the end? Because, you see, as my colleagues have already said, I thought the intended objective was to ensure that the consumer at the end of the day benefit, you know, and is not also being taken for granted. Food prices are very high. And as you showed us, they've been increasing, especially bread. And I haven't seen any sign of, you know, down pricing after all this, you know, actions have been, after your settlements and leniencies and conclusion of every case that you went through. You know, situations still remain. And then what's the use then of spending so much money, you know, settling with people? You know, they are rich. They can be able, they can afford, they can settle, you know. At the end of the day, the main person who suffers is the beneficiary, the person who's supposed to be beneficiating from the whole thing. He's not benefiting. He suffers. So maybe if I understand it the other way, it will, maybe from your side, from a point of view, maybe I will understand if after explanation. And the fact that it's not only about the consumers, about even the role players. You've said when you looked at the structure of the food market itself, it's very difficult for new entrants to come in because of this particular behavior of those who are really monopolizing the market. difficult. And have we seen through this process of the Competition Commission many new entrants benefiting, being able to enter the market after you've taken certain decisions? Because to me, that is the if I were to say the Competition Commission has done its work for seeing the things reversing. Because if there's no reversal of anything, then it's as good as not doing anything. Because they'll go back, they'll settle, they'll go back and do business as usual. I'm trying to say the plight of the people is at stake here. And I think the whole process was to ensure that we protect them. Maybe it's because you don't have the authority to direct that. It's something else I think you need to tell us. You've indicated that your main cost driver is around litigation. I just want to understand what that means in essence. Because it might mean many things. If, for instance, your systems don't run properly, obviously they won't respect the timelines, and then you'll find yourself, you know, lagging behind in terms of responses, whether court responses or the very same people that you're challenging. And then later on, they will, of course, take you on the issues that you've spoken to. I just want you to tell us, actually, what is it that you have in plan to reduce that? If it's systems in place, or if it's about the person power, I think one of my colleagues asked that question. What is it that really is... I understand you might argue the way you are arguing, but the fact of the matter is you might argue against a company today, but if that recurs, then it will become a burden to the commission itself. Unlike looking inward, detecting where challenges are, and being able to correct so that you can, at the end of the day, become efficient as an agency. And if you are efficient, then you'll also, your turnaround in handling some of the cases will be quite very good. So those are the issues that I wanted to clarify. Over to you for responses, Mr. Ambrose.
Those are very nice questions, and I'm going to deal with much as I can and pass. If I leave any gaps, Simon and Tembi will help me out. Let's just deal with the last question first, because it kind of deals with a number of things that is implicit in the other questions as well. And I think what is absolutely 100% right is that the success of the work of the competition authorities at the end of the day must be measured by the two things you mentioned. A, the extent to which it benefits consumers in terms of prices, in terms of quality of products, in terms of the range of products that they offered. I think that's definitely the kind of main reason. That's in whose name we go about doing our work, in the name of consumers, and I think it's right that ultimately that's the indicator. That's the first indicator. And the second indicator, particularly for an economy like ours, is the number of new entrants entering in the market. What competition policy and competition law needs to do is to create spaces for new entrants to enter, which means breaking down the stranglehold of the old boys club on the marketplace and in different markets. I mean, I think that's right. And, you know, I think that certainly we realize that's what's that's ultimately what we will be measured by. In our last strategic planning, for example, we're going to put considerable more effort into monitoring and evaluating the results and impact of our work. That is not something we've done, to be honest, to a great extent right now, but it's possibly not something we could have done because you need to leave time before you come back and assess impact. You can't just do something and assess impact immediately afterwards. So I think that that's something we need to kind of look at going forward on the impact of our work. And we will be putting a lot of thinking into how, what methodologies one uses in order to make these measurements. I mean, it's not, I think, a very easy thing to do. Then, I mean, related to that is the question of whether the fines are a sufficient deterrent. I mean, I think everybody quite instinctively, and I've said this many times, is certainly there are instances where the fine is not a deterrent. People just merely incorporate it into their costs. You know, they budget for it up front. Let's budget this number of million rand for a competition commission fine because it's more worthwhile, as people have pointed out, for them to continue with the anti-competitive behavior because they make more profits out of that even if they're fined. In other words, profits minus fine, they're better off rather than kind of seizing the behavior altogether. I mean, I think there are instances in which that occurs, and a lot of the kind of thinking underlining the amendments, the Competition Act, used this as a starting point. The whole kind of criminalization, for example, was something that came into being because people felt very strongly that these fines were not deterrent enough. Now, let's remember that the fines in the current Competition Act is not a fine that punishes people. It's not a punishment fine. It's a deterrent fine. It's like, you know, it's like speeding tickets. You know, they tell you 120 and they don't want you to speed, but if the fine is there to prevent you from speeding rather than to punish you once you've sped. It must deter you. It must be a disincentive. And that's how our act is constructed. It's not criminal law. It's civil law. It's kind of, these are administrative penalties. That's what they are. They're not meant to be punishments. And the kind of move, I think, in the Competition Amendment Bill to criminalization is to add the punishment element to it, which is... You may be aware, a jail sentence of up to 10 years for individuals who might be involved in anti-competitive behavior. And I think that is, you know, the thinking behind it is that is what will be a proper disincentive. If people think they're going to go to jail, then they're certainly not going to kind of continue with this kind of behavior. I mean, I think that another thing to share with you is that we've struggled in the Commission in the recent past to raise the level of our fines. If you look at the earlier fines that were handed out to transgressors, if you look at the motor vehicle case, for example, I mean, people got away in that motor vehicle case with very, very small fines. It's only subsequent to that that we started raising the fines, both in percentage terms and in the way in which it is calculated. So now the Commission calculates the fine in terms of the turnover of a corporate entity much higher up in the corporate ladder. You know, previously we looked at just the small section of the business and what that was involved in anti-competitive behavior, looked what their turnover was and calculated on the basis of just the affected business, that part of the business that was involved in the anti-competitive behavior. But more and more we are now calculating the fine from at a higher level in the corporate structure, okay, for the whole business. There's always a kind of legal problem around that where parties make arguments that might be an unfair thing, and we've got to kind of engage with that. But certainly we want the from our side, we want responsibility to be taken at the highest level in the corporate structure. And hence, we kind of target the highest level for the fine. I think that there's so whether we're deterrent or not is something we need to, I mean, I suspect that some of the fines, like 250 million rand to Sasol, is not, I think, a slap on the wrist. I think it's a reasonable fine. People might think otherwise, but, you know, we the way we determine a settlement, whether to settle with the company or not, is we ask ourselves whether the settlement gives us substantively the same thing we would have won if we'd won the case. You know, so we say, look, if we win this case, what would we get? What is the settlement, and what is the difference between the settlement and outright winning the case? And we must be pretty close to what we would have got if we won something outright to settle. We won't settle for a very small percentage of what we would have got if we didn't win the case. Sorry, John.
Yes, I just wanted to interrupt you there, because you see, you're saying this is the very same question we're asking. It's about you winning the case. And we say, is it really about you winning the case? Or is it about reversing issues?
Right. You know, no, I'll
because
guess,
that is critical, Mr. Ambrose, when you answer this question. Because is it about penalizing that for the sake of you as a commission to say that at least you've managed, you know, to win the case against this? And winning, what does that mean in essence? Because winning, they give you so much money. The consumer doesn't benefit from that at the end of the day. How does the consumer benefit?
Right. Okay, when I say winning the case, I mean that if we pursued the case in the courts to its conclusion, right, would we be able to make the, sorry about this, would we be able to make the legal case, look, I take your point about whether, about, I understand what you're saying. Just understand what I'm saying is that if there's a choice between pursuing a matter or settling a matter, we settle it on the basis that if we had pursued it, we would have got substantially the same thing as the settlement. Right? So in other words, we say, if we carried on with this case, if it went to the competition tribunal, we're asking for an 8% of turnover fine. These guys are offering us 7.8% instead of 8%, or 7.5%. You know, should we quibble over that 5% and go to all the trouble to win the case in the courts, or should we settle? And we settle when the gap between what the settlement is and what our preferred outcome in the court is must be very narrow. Okay, that's the one part of your answer. But the other part of your answer is, I think that I've pointed out that these fines are not about punishment. These fines are about deterring particular kinds of anti-competitive behavior. What is always first prize for us is that anti-competitive behavior that led to higher prices stops. And inevitably, always, both in our settlements and in orders of the tribunal, it's not only the fine that is ordered. That gets most of the public attention. That gets the newspapers. But what is also ordered, and what is an important part of a settlement, is a description of what the behavior was and a commitment that behavior will never occur again. That's a non-negotiable part of our settlement. It's not like we'll settle just with a fine. We must settle with an admission that a particular behavior occurred and it will not occur again.
We'll take that, Mr. Ambrose.
Okay.
You see, it's not satisfactory because in a case where within a year or within 6 months, you know, the price increases threefold, and we expect the consumer to say we are settled, we are okay with that, with the,
right,
with whatever the outcome of the, you know, of the settlement of the court is.
Okay.
I think that is the main thing that we are more concerned about. It
right.
must benefit not the commission. Yes, the commission should have, you know, made it open or made it known that at least this company is doing wrong things, which is, I think, it's something that is commendable. But we want to even hear more. I think that's what the public wants to know. To hear more, what is it for? Is in that for us? Because yes, you have actually exposed, but after exposure, what happens? Because that is critical to all of us. And I think that's what the public is more concerned about. I think that area is the gist of, you know, most of the questions that were asked here.
Fair enough. I'm going to ask
okay.
Simon to answer some of that before I move on to the other questions.
Okay,
before
Simon comes in, I think there's a follow-up on Memphis. Because I want us to reemphasize
okay.
this, because I know you've appeared in many committees.
We'll get back to that, yeah.
Yes.
Chairperson, I think for us as public representatives who meet consumers on a daily basis, we have you know, direct contact with them. We'll be happy with the situation whereby the Competition Commission, you know, sometimes send inspectors to the local traders. I mean, initially when we agreed that the ShopRite, Checkers, Pick and Pay, those calls should be, you know, nearer to the people in order to save us the transport costs. But the minute they put their prices, it's just a vicious cycle. We don't see consumers benefiting. So if we can have inspectors overseeing them or monitoring like we do, Department of Labor, health inspectors, the health department, you know, they go to shops and see, not prices, but if food is in good condition for our health. So if we can see you sending inspectors to the local traders, because that's where consumers are. People cannot buy in bulk, but just buy smaller and other things. They cannot go to town. So even if you deal with big business like Sasol and them, still it doesn't change much, you know, the future quo of our poor communities, because it benefits maybe farmers if you deal with standards. The farmers are the ones who are going to benefit, but down there the prices are still the same.
Okay. I'm gonna ask my colleagues to sure.
Well, Chair, I think you have emphasized this issue, and I really concur, because this is the map of our responsibility. And I must say, Chair, through you, that the Competition Commission actually gained popularity and quite significantly by unraveling all these and sort of irregularities. But sustaining that can actually be a very big challenge, because to unravel something does not mean that you have cured it. It may actually lead to a worse situation, because it is in the human nature to change approaches immediately you have been identified or you have been exposed. And that's where the danger of this whole thing is. And the people on the ground continue to suffer. Our worry is beneficiation to the people. That is why, for instance, I was making the proposal that how about you come up with that and the penalty or whatever you find, then you cap the price. You say you keep your prices for 5 years at this level, because you have been increasing the prices so unfairly. And that money which is coming back is not going back to those people. It's not equal to the money that you have actually robbed the people, if we're to use such crude terms. And I'm just raising that, because I really believe that it's an issue, and that needs to be addressed. And also the last issue, Chair, is the question of consulting with the ordinary people on this issue.
let me just make an example. You see, if you take one of these big companies and they sell their products to small traders, when they sell the product, maybe on credit, if that trader doesn't pay money, everybody knows what happens to that sole trader. That sole trader even goes to an extent of being liquidated and gets arrested. But the reverse doesn't happen because of the size. Again, the monopolists, the oligopolists, get away with murder. There's no liquidation that says that you have been robbing people, you are getting liquidated. No. But they have the recourse themselves against the small trader. So it is within that. And therefore consultation so that the fairness, people understand exactly that your work and the work of the government and the people is actually taking them very seriously. I think this issue has to be emphasized. We understand, that's why initially myself I asked the question of capacity. Do we have the capacity? Because it may be that we're loading you with everything and yet you don't have the capacity. You have actually responded on the question of your limitations with regard to the law. We have to look at that as well. I'm sorry to take long.
Thank you. May we give it
okay. Look, I must say, this is what we're talking about, the cutting edge of the debates we have to deal with, right? And I mean, I acknowledge all these points. Is I don't have right or wrong answers to all of them, but these are things that we all need to be engaging with. I want Simon to talk a little bit about capping and the pricing issues, but if I can just make a few points around what was said as an introduction, in fact, because Ken, you might want to say something as well. Is firstly, I think, you know, the short answer to your question about capacity is that if you want us to do all the things you're suggesting we do, firstly, we might not be able to do it because the legislation doesn't allow us to do it. But even of all the things we have to do within the legislation, the short answer is no, we don't have the capacity to do everything, which is why as an organization we've prioritized and decided to do a few limited things, and even there, the more we succeed in doing those limited things, the greater the expectation is of us to do more and more. We can talk a little bit more about that, and there's a whole range of reasons around that. But a more important point here, and a point that we've often made, is that you've put it very nicely. What we do is we kind of unravel, we expose what's going on, and we slap a fine on it. But in addressing all the complexities of the issues around a particular expose, say, there must be a whole range of other institutions in this society that needs to come to the party, as it were. You know, all of them with their own respective powers, laws, interests, etc. So, for example, you know, the credit issue, that's something that, you know, we have institutions in this country to deal with that. The kind of health and safety issue around the products there are consumer laws to deal with that. So I think that one of the things that's very important to our work is the complementarity that other institutions play in relation to our work. And there's two main areas here which I've often spoken about. One is around getting more consumer involvement. You know, this is your consultation point. This is about getting consumer organizations to speak and on behalf of consumers, getting more activism from consumer organizations around what affects them. I think that's the one side of things. And the other side of things, and equally important, is in the corporate structures and corporate decision making, to get the boards of directors, for example, to pay greater amounts of attention and take more responsibility around the consequences of anti-competitive behavior of the firms that they're responsible for. I mean, if all of these different institutions kick in and kind of play their role in making sure there's good governance, there's good accountability, I think that that will certainly kind of achieve the kinds of outcomes people are referring to here. This is not to be defensive. I think that we, you know, we play an important role, but we're not going to do all of this ourselves. Other people need to play a role around it as well. The one point before I hand to Simon is just to say that the way we see our work is we want to create high levels of competition and fairness in a marketplace. And we've never seen our role as therefore fixing prices. We don't want your I'm responding to your capping suggestion. We've never seen our role as fixing prices. I mean, you know, fixing prices is fixing prices. We're averse to it when private people do it for private interests. When government does it as part of its through kind of properly constructed regulations, then that's government doing it. That's a kind of policy call, a public policy issue that they're taking up, and they will do it as in the case of the petrol price, as in the case of telecommunication prices. All of these are kind of regulated by government that through kind of very specific regimes and acts and rules, and we don't see our role as fixing, as setting prices, or, you know, even if it's just a cap. Our role is to free up the market so that people can participate freely and fairly in it and get the market to set the best price. And you know, with the kind of hope that if everything is fair, that price will be fair all around. Simon, do you want to add to this?
I'm just going to come in to talk about specifically about the bread price issue, because it's something that we've been looking at, and maybe worth just also explaining that I head the policy and research division, which is a small team of economists. Now, those are not specialist economists like you would have in a regulated institution for telecommunications. You have specialist telecoms economists, etc. So they're working on all sorts of different markets. Some of them would probably like to fix the prices and get it down. In fact, we all would want prices to come down. But we've been spending a lot of time looking at the bread price issue. And we're very unhappy as well about what we see happening in the market. And there's two points we want to highlight about that. Is that the Act prohibits people from colluding. So we have to now reinvestigate firms to understand if the prices that are staying at those levels are there because they've actually had an agreement. So we have to find some kind of agreement. That's how the law is structured. We might want to say, look, it looks like there's a problem, and go after the companies again. But to do that, we have to find an agreement. We have to prove an agreement. So we're looking at it, and we're watching, and we're monitoring the prices, and that's what we're involved in, essentially a monitoring exercise at the moment. What we're doing is looking at the input costs. So the wheat price is the main input cost. And then you've got the energy costs, both the energy for milling the wheat, which is mainly, I think, electricity, and then you've got all the transport costs, and then you've got the packaging and distribution costs. So when we look at the price of bread, which we're looking at, we've also got to monitor over time what's happening to those costs. And so what we really need to understand is the margin that's being made, because if the wheat price went up, and it did go up, it's, I think, almost doubled, then clearly that's an input cost to the companies. And that we have to look at that as a separate issue, and we import about 30% of our wheat. So, you know, we're in a situation where that's where the inputs are coming from, a large part of it. So we're going through that exercise and devoting resources to it. But the other thing we want to say is that we're looking at facilitating conduct which means that companies can return to similar ways of doing things without getting together and meet. Clearly, if you said, look, if you meet, we're going to go after you, so that, you know, they don't meet. So they have to find other ways of facilitating it. And this is where we're looking at the activities of industry associations. So and I want to be specific here, in terms of the bread, you've got the Chamber of Baking. And in terms of the milling of flour, the bread producers also mill the flour, you've got a Chamber of Milling. those producers also mill mealy meal. So we're looking at their control in the value chain back into the milling of the wheat into flour, and also we're looking at mealy meal as well. And we're looking at the information that they exchange. In other words, to what extent is this old boys club, really is what it is, it's the four producers, it's just, you know, managers who've known each other for decades and decades, are able to continue with understanding in ways that look might look legitimate because they've got these industry associations. And the second thing there is we're looking at how they exchange information around the sales volumes. And we are going after the fact that they continue to send sales data to the industry association, and so they can work out their market shares over time. Now, what we're hoping or would like to see is we'd like to see prices coming down. So we'd like to see some of them going out there and discounting. And that's what we expect of competition. You go out, you discount, and you try and win market share. Now, if your rivals, and there's only three rivals, if there's four companies, there's only, you know, three rivals to any one competitor, are able to see they've lost market share immediately because they're giving sales data every month to the Chamber of Milling or Chamber of Baking, then that's something which just increases what they would call stability in the market. We want instability. We want prices coming down. We want price wars. So we're looking at a range of other arrangements, but it's really, I think the kind of big picture is we're actually quite early on the road. And so it's very important, I know the point's been made that the press has built us up, and said, but I think it's very important for us to be humble and say very clearly that we find the agreements, getting together, meeting in hotels, meeting in bars, telephone calls, whatever. Okay, so this was what was uncovered. But we haven't necessarily uncovered all the arrangements, the understandings, the human psychology, etc. We engage in that process within the powers of the Act. So we want to be very clear that we are not at the end of a road at all. The other thing we want to highlight there is related investigations in the milling of wheat and the milling of maize into mealy meal. Those are still underway, and we're hoping to finalize them soon. So the people may not be aware that it's actually much wider than bread. But I think we want to be, just say, within the powers that we've got, that's what we're engaged in. The last thing on capping of prices is that the, you know, the tribunal imposes the remedy, not the commission. And the tribunal imposes the remedies they're allowed to impose in terms of the Act. And so price regulation is not a power in the Act, and it also wouldn't be a power that we would impose. The tribunal has to confirm the settlements. And so that structure is quite an important structure to be cognizant of. And the tribunal has said in the Steele case, for example, clearly that they are not price regulators. So we share your sentiments, but we want to also be able to progress and build our capacity and take our analysis forward. And that's really what we're trying to do at the moment.
You enforce, you exempt. That's one of your responsibilities, or two of your responsibilities. And I think through that you can force some of the things to happen. It's very important that you remember that, because you might be having power but not using that authority, you know, effectively. Mr. Bonagene?
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if I'm going to provide answers, but maybe I can widen the debate. First, to acknowledge that no matter how much we think we might be knowledgeable in competition law, that this is not our debate, at least not our debate alone. I think there are very serious policy questions that are being posed, and the best answers we can give are based on our experiences as competition practitioners, what we think competition law can deliver as a solution. It's important to reflect on the scheme of our competition law as it currently exists, because I think that inbuilt in that system are some of the things that are being raised. What's envisaged, for an example, for consumers or victims of things like collusion and so on? There's a very big assumption in competition law that once you have competition, once you have competitive markets, prices will fall. So in other words, by uncovering the conduct, and uncovering is not a small thing, we can talk about that, but by uncovering the conduct and making sure that in a particular market there is competition, there is an assumption that naturally prices would be fair in a market, in a free market environment. Now, whether that assumption is valid or not is something else, but that's what the law allows us to do. We may say that that's not adequate. You actually need to put a price cap, as is being suggested. In terms of what consumers can do, I just want to make, sorry about this, one example outside the food environment. In the infrastructure, we're talking to municipalities, for an example. There's a cartel we uncover that's been running since the 1970s on concrete products. Now, it doesn't matter how much the fine you can level there, it will never be adequate to compensate what's been happening since the 1970s. But if you don't have competition laws, there's a possibility that you may never uncover it at all. So if you had it since the 1970s, and it's been happening for all of these years, you can have it going on and on without uncovering it. So that's one big intervention that you make with competition law. What happens after that is something else that we must talk about. But uncovering, I want to argue, is not a small thing. Once you have uncovered and ran the case, what the scheme of our law also allows is compensation. This is what we're talking about with municipalities, that we can uncover and level a fine of up to 10%, which is the best we can do. But as municipalities, too, you have a role that you can play, which is to claim damages you have suffered since the 1970s. That's what the law allows people to do. Now, nobody is asking, even public sector victims of this conduct, what are they doing about it? I think beyond the public sector, we need to be asking, what are consumers doing about it themselves? If you have a bread cartel, there is a right in terms of the law to claim damages from bread companies. That law doesn't allow us to claim damages on behalf of consumers. It only allows us to level fine. Now, someone must be picking that up. But there's also something else, which is once a cartel has been uncovered in the bread industry, I think we said last time we were talking to a committee of parliament that it seems like a market that's very easy to enter. Why are there no bakeries out there? I would submit it's not a question that's just solely going to be answered by the Competition Commission. Why can't we have emerging aspirant entrepreneurs baking bread and supplying our people with bread? Is it a question of finance? Is it a question of the value chain within the flour market, which is what the Competition Commission is dealing with, and so on? So I just want to suggest that I think there are harder questions that we ourselves are asking as a commission, but I think these are questions that all of us need to be asking. I'm happy we've started this debate, because whenever we go and talk to competition authorities outside, if you go to the East, you'll find that the Koreans are very much concerned about the nature of their market, and their competition laws and rules are designed in a way that responds to their particular situation. And so if you have policymakers starting to engage with these issues, I think we will be much better off.
Sorry, I think we've answered most of the questions except the one on fish. I don't know, Tembi, do you want to But before that, I think that, I mean, I think just to kind of summarize and maybe repeat some of the points and answer the question on kind of resources, is I think that, as Tembi puts it, like uncovering what has been hidden for decades is not a small thing. I mean, I think that's a big thing in itself. Yeah.
You've done a good job uncovering.
Right.
But then you leave it, you know, there. Because it will take you how many more years to uncover that?
But
because
yeah.
The robbers just said, you know, it's very difficult. You also said, Mr. Ramadan,
absolutely.
To
no,
go back, you know, to initiate again an investigation, it will take you more, you have to prove that really there's a reason behind that for you to investigate that. Whereas, after doing so much work, you then leave it, you know, without following it up. Because that's where the concern is. And I think, even though you are saying it's only the role of the tribunal, I think also you can. Because in the process of negotiating, Mr. Roberts and Mr. Ambrose, in the process of negotiating with this company, you can set up conditions as part of your settlement, for instance. And that on its own, I feel it will make it easier for consumers and also for other, you know, Mr. Bonagel is saying, for other entrants, you know, to come into the market. But unless you have systems, for instance, these are the weaknesses that your system, your agency must look into. You must have a particular, you know, units within the agency itself that will make sure that they follow up on this issue. For instance, even the issue of the issue that you've raised of ensuring that other role players come in, they wouldn't know when to come in unless you inform them, you plan with them. They will know that, for instance, we are on this, you know, we are busy with this issue now, and it might take us so long, and then we would like you to come in at this stage, you know, when we feel we are ready with the whole issue. But otherwise, to expect them to jump in, you know, like that without collaborating with them, it's not going to be easy for anyone to understand where you are in terms of the work that you are doing. So I think it's something that you can build in within your system so that you are able to respond fully to the issues that you are raising. We understand, you know, the depth of the issues we are dealing with. It's not that we think they are easy. They are not easy. But, you know, the whole thing is around how you do it. Because if you have an objective in mind, a goal to reach, then you'll be able to know what to prepare. Because without planning for that, you won't be able to realize the end result. Because if you're in your mind, you want to, I understand you don't want to punish, but you just want to find. If that is your ultimate goal, then it will lead you to that. But if you have other things beyond that find, then it's easy also to lead to that, because you'll realize during the planning process whom then to involve in order to, at the end of the day, benefit, you know, the consumer or whoever that is that the investigation is intending to. So we are saying, yes, we understand the complexity of your work, but we do also feel that it's within, you know, the framework of your work that you can be able to achieve what we are talking about. I don't think it's impossible.
Okay, that's a fair point, and I think we always kind of open for kind of, you know, honing in on and doing our work more effectively. I just want to be, like, perfectly honest and open about one matter here, though, and that is the trap that I think we find ourselves in often is the more we do, the more we expose, the more success we have, the more is thrown back at us to do even more, and often outside of what we are legally able to do and outside of what we have the capacity to do. So, you know, okay, so I just want to make that point because it's a scary point for people like us with limited capacity and having to, you know, being asked to do all these very interesting things which I would love to do. We would all grab doing all of these things. The two points is whether we have the power to do it and whether we have the capacity to do it, as you've pointed out. And I think that I can't overemphasize the point around the complementarity of other institutions, other structures, you know, particularly those within the corporate sector. We leave them out somehow. No, I don't hear a lot of people saying, you know, addressing issues of governance, corporate governance. What are all of these people sitting on boards doing? What do they do? Why aren't we talking to them about the role they play in kind of facilitating all of that? I mean, I think that's equally important to all the points made about consumers, I think. And I think that, you know, finally, around systems, that the point you make around systems, that's a point we engage with. We've kind of, you know, we undertake kind of state-of-the-art strategic planning exercises. We think hard about this. We have good documents and plans to show how we integrate our work both within the organization and attempt to kind of share it across with other organizations to create efficiencies and make these complementarities kind of work all around. That's a very valuable point you make, and I think that, yes, we kind of committed to stretching this law to the limit, which I think we've done. I think if you look at a lot of our legal challenges to us, it is about us stretching the law and trying to get out of it as much as we can in terms of a developmental agenda. Sorry, there's a fish point somebody must make, but Simon also wants to say something.
You're not disengaging with the development because we're here as much as you want to understand, but we still, you must also understand the gaps that you're trying to identify so that you can also empower yourself and
Chair, I wanted just to say that what I take home out of this is, in my view, if there is no code that is really and sort of accepted by all parties with regard to pricing and related issues, especially in ensuring that within the context of liberalization, and I fired the question initially, and I think that what your response was that, and in response to that, and there was the necessity for the involvement of other institutions maybe to look at the question of the implications of the 1996 decision. And but the question of code, Chair, I wonder if it's not something, if you don't have it, so that we understand, what is it that is guiding, so to speak, general behavior, and it's known by people, it's circulated, it's publicized, so that people understand that this is what we expect, and because within that context, it takes me to the next point, that implicitly you raise the involvement of other institutions, in that case, especially the consumer, the involvement of civil society in this case. Civil society organizations, it's inevitable that they have to be involved. The question of corporate governance and through the chambers themselves to also give the monitoring. And of course, there's another very important one that I believe myself that said, and I don't want to emphasize, but you mentioned it. I think that it's something that we can and look at as a committee. But, Chair, I want to actually say that
I don't think that our colleagues on the other side, they actually understand us. As we raise these questions, it's not that we're criticizing, we're trying to punish you.
We're
raising them because of anxiety, of wanting to do good for the people and to ensure that this must stop. Because if it doesn't stop, it means that our societal behavior is rotting, especially within the economic sector. You catch people on corruption, small and people, but the big companies continue wantonly. And that's where we're coming from, as well as beneficiation to the people. And we are really not, we are appreciating and the amount of work that they are doing, really. But we are so much agitated and sort of anxious that this kind of behavior and ethics must come to an end.
We actually want to push you to the limit because we can realize we are doing good, but we want you to do even more because, yes, you've done so far in as so far as you have, but then there's a possibility of even, you know, doing more.
I should say we understand. I mean, we understand. We indeed, we share a lot of the sentiment and frustration that's coming out in this discussion. We share it.
Mr. Rambarush, you see, I get a feeling that you also want us. Well, you see, you are supposed to be leading this. You see, in terms of the issues that you are raising, you must also, as you go into your strategic planning session, ask this, yourself this question. Because you've been in existence for how long now?
10 years.
For 10 years, yes. So really, by now, experience should have taught you that really you need to even, you know, expand and do more. I don't know in terms of resources, how you negotiate for resources or how do you motivate for resources, because that's another thing. Because for you to be doing well and to be making a valuable contribution, especially in as far as your functions are concerned, you really need to be to convince everybody that this is really what you want to do and this is what is possible. And I think we will go into the law itself, the act itself. Because the act, when, you know, I haven't gone through it in, you know, in detail, but in as so far as I've gone through it, I understand your work to be real, I understand you to be having lots of power. And I still maintain that some of these powers, you are not using them effectively. And you can do that. You can affect some of them. So that if you teach one or two companies a lesson, there will be others will be scared. Because not just for finding for the purposes of, you know, registering that I've done my work. We want to see the impact. Mem Sotetsi, Dr. Huang?
Chairperson, I think actually the questions and concerns you are raising is actually an appeal to say, help us go down to the ordinary men and women in the street. Because for us, they're the people who matter when it comes to price fixing. And as it is said that they're not punishing, I just want to check what actions do you take against habitual offenders? Because if people make a maximum profit, they'll even budget for the fine. It's nothing to them. They'll keep on, you know, offending on and on and on. And on interventions, you talked about advocacy. For me, I thought it's about disseminating information to the public and also tell them what you have uncovered and also advise as to what steps should they take in order for them to benefit. Actually, to say what they stand to benefit if they take a certain action depending on your advice.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's a 10-year, like you say. 10 years is already from small kids must grow up, become the big tiger. Because you're facing all the lion company. If you are small, you are still a small kid. I can tell you, I guarantee you, after 10 years, 20 years, you still can't catch this big lion. Because now you, I wish it's the government authority, you are the commission, can doing the right job. Even you say your strategical plan, I like that you can present to the little committee. We want to see what your action plan. Because we are deep concerned. You are stole the small cat. How you can catch it for big lion? I wish you are the big tiger, not the small cat. 10 years passed, my friend.
We also want to find out, is there a way communities can be assisted to claim for damages? You know, that's the one question. But then the other question is where we find that communities are discriminated against. In other words, discrimination that we have historically been having is perpetuated even in an economic way. For an example, but I'm not sure whether this falls in your ambit or whether it falls outside. But for an example, you find that in a certain upmarket area, a certain shop will have its shop at the best quality in all respects, you know, which means even the things that are sold there are fresh, they are kept clean. And then you then find the same shop goes to a township, and then it then lowers the standards completely. You know, you find it's like the dumping place. I even suspect that some of the township shops are used as dumping places by the same big shops to say, no, this is about to reach its limit, expiry date, take it to the township, you know. Because if that does fall in your ambit, it will assist if there's a way of tackling that. Because if we don't tackle that, it means that that habit will perpetuate.
Ask my colleagues to answer some of the questions and make points that they're keen to make on other issues. On the advocacy point, we do have kind of targeted advocacy programs for particular constituencies. So we've done things with trade unions, with the business community, with lawyers, with franchise associations. You know, targeted thing. For the general public, the best advocacy we can get is the kind of just being in the news and kind of informing people through the general media on what we're doing. And, you know, generally people are not kind of interested in some of the more technical markets we're dealing with, you know, some chemical product or long steel or, you know, sulfuric acid or, you know, those things people are not interested in. But when it comes to like bread and milk and consumer goods, the kind of coverage we get there is important in educating people around the kinds of work that we do. We certainly would be very pleased to share our strategic planning exercise with you. I mean, I think that a lot of the successes you see now were kind of invested in 3-4 years ago. I mean, that's when I came into this organization three, four years ago, started onto a strategic planning exercise. It is slow, painstaking work to build an institution up. I know it's 10 years is a long time, but I mean, the kind of work that we do doesn't have quick turnaround times. Investigation takes a long time. Litigation takes a long time. But in the course of all of this, we're creating a lot of awareness both within the markets and outside, and a lot of, I believe, a lot of behaviors get changed on those, on account of that rather than on account of kind of decisions being taken by court. In other words, you know, if all other players in a particular market understand how that market works through the information we've uncovered and put out there, that's important in terms of how that market is functioning. I think communities being assisted to claim damages, I think this is an important point that is being increasingly raised by a whole range of people. I know there are a lot of people thinking about how that can happen. The legal profession is thinking about it, about setting some kind. In Joburg, I know the Northern Provinces Law Society is suggesting that they might be able to facilitate some of that. Some NGOs are also looking at that, but I think that's an important gap in the system. And Tembi, do you want to add some?
The chair is just out now, party. She said I have to continue chairing this meeting. I would like you, when you respond to the follow-ups, to look at the initial questions as well, so that you try to, because we don't have enough time.
I was going to come back to one of the initial questions, actually, on the issue about land use and land being converted into game farms and this kind of thing. I think this was one of the questions which wasn't dealt with. Clearly there's other areas, other institutions which regulate land use, but what we've found from, and again, this is more the research side of things, if you wanted to look at what's happened in terms of how the power in the kind of agro-food value chain has moved over time. Now, if you look at the food is produced using the input, using the land, using labor, it's sold, it's then processed, goes right through to the retail level, If you want to characterize it, the farmers used to be very supported under apartheid. White farmers were very supported under apartheid with loans and inputs, and they had cooperatives. What we've seen is the cooperatives becoming privatized. We've seen quite a lot of the support being withdrawn in terms of the regulatory boards, and we've seen that power moving more to the processing level and to the people who supply the inputs. So you've seen the fertilizer providers, suppliers, for example, the people who store the grain, as well as the people who buy the grain. Those are all very concentrated, and a lot of power exists at those levels. Fertilizer, we highlighted a bit, and I think it's important to come back to this just to emphasize how important it is. It's so important that donors have subsidized fertilizer programs in Zambia and Malawi to increase food production. It's been applauded as one of the most successful donor-supported programs was to subsidize fertilizer to small farmers in Malawi. Now, where does that fertilizer come from? It comes from South Africa, and it's priced at a cartel price. Now, we are not subsidizing, so the subsidy is counterbalancing some of the anti-competitive pricing. But South African farmers have been paying that cartel price that has been going on for some time. We also have, on the input supply to the fertilizer, an even bigger challenge, because two of the main inputs are made by monopolies. It's not a cartel case, it's about excessive pricing. And excessive pricing cases go on for a very long time. This is the similar to the case we've referred against Telkom on the broadband pricing in terms of the amount of evidence that you bring to bear. So we have referred a case in 2005 on excessive pricing on the main single biggest fertilizer input, which is ammonia, which is made by Sasol. And we've prosecuted the cartel at the next level, which adds a little margin on top or a margin on top. But the core thing about getting fertilizer prices down, which will benefit not just South African farmers, but the whole Southern African region to become a big food producer, to regenerate agriculture in the region, is a question that we are only one institution that can deal with it. This is something that I think, if one is looking at this, we need to think about bringing what can be brought to bear. And these are the kind of things that are impacting on land use. Obviously, the other institutions that are around land use, but if farming becomes less profitable, then it's going to be more attractive to people to park the land, maybe speculate, whatever. But we can see the input costs have gone up and the farming margins have gone down. That is what comes out of our research. On complementary actions, I just wanted to highlight a couple of examples where there have been some success stories, and we've talked to, we engaged with the Department of Agriculture about these issues. We've also talked to, we've been to the Eastern Cape a couple of times, and other provinces as well, but the Eastern Cape has got an initiative where they are investing in silos for storage, and they're investing in milling. So this is the province getting involved in building competitors to the big groups through storage and through milling. Both of those are also able to buy products from the farmers. If you've got small-scale farming developing in Eastern Cape, you can't sell that product if you can't store it. You know, you're a small-scale farmer, you're not going to build a huge silo on your farm, but you need a silo. And then you need the milling operations locally to sell the maize. So it's an integrated, it's part of the integrated actions that's happening in the Eastern Cape. So there are things that are going on there. We've also talked to the IDC about supporting small bakeries and that kind of thing. But we're just providing an input into this, and we hope that this is getting picked up, and we hope that the initiatives in Eastern Cape, which is just one example, really, you know, is really part of developing small-scale agriculture in that province. So I just wanted to mention that. On fish, I think Rabbi has left. He's coming back. We should hold it. It's a... The issue about the export, I mean, we have got a case about an export, I think it relates to a cartel on the export side, but if you wanted to stop the exports to get more local supplies, that's then a trade policy question. So there's a, if you're looking at intervening in terms of having some kind of quota or some restriction on exports, it's very much firmly in the trade policy arena. It's not something we would be able to deal with, no matter how much we may, you know, share the sentiments. It's clearly something to ask the DTI, I think.
Can I also just, in addition to what Simon said, that I think the biggest thing we see the law and what it can achieve. Perhaps what we might have resigned ourselves to is what we think are the limitations of the law. And how we've been approaching this is there's a lot of coordination that is needed to achieve the kind of high impact that we're looking for. There are areas where we think we might have an impact, and we accept that ultimately that's what we need to be judged on. But in this issue of making sure that we have competitive markets, for example, is an issue that we think, quite frankly, requires a number of players. And an example is what Simon has mentioned with silos. If you have a market, let's take, for example, steel, if you have a problem with steel prices, you can prosecute for 10 years an excessive pricing case, which is a very difficult case to do. Or you can have an entry to compete for production of steel. We think that if you have coordination with institutions such as the IDC, you might have PIP, you are likely to have a much more sustainable intervention rather than a sort of kind of, because I accept that litigation is a bit of a bash-and-go kind of intervention. If you have a problem with metal steel, well, we think that the best, I mean, if metal steel is an absolute monopoly, there's two things you can do. You can't regulate the price, then you must find a competitor for metal steel, as an example. Otherwise, it's going to continue wanting to extract rents. There's just no, I mean, there's no litigation solution to it. Short term, and we're working on it, but it's not sustainable. The same thing happens to fertilizer. I mean, we engaged in a lot of discussion with industry players in agriculture, and what we're finding in fertilizer. But what we're finding is that you need to undermine the cartel. You only have three players. You need to undermine the cartel by bringing in more players. You might need more investment by some of the players to be able to do this. So I go back again that I think it's, and I think government has recognized this important issue of coordination in the interventions that are being made. And we are only one component of that. I'm not saying less important, but I think we need to recognize that a meaningful impact will be done and will be achieved through making sure that we see the overall impact of all of these interventions. That's just one point that I thought I think is very important for this discussion.
Thank you. Is that all?
I also should say that we take the point about looking at the armory in our toolkit, and we're going to go back with that and see what more we can achieve with the tools that we have. And I would equally invite the committee also to really look at that legislation and see whether and maybe there can be a discussion about whether there can be any additional tool that would enhance the work that we do. But we take the point that there's a lot more that we can do with what we've got.
There's one question that they missed.
I missed the response on habitual offenders.
Oh, habitual offenders.
And the other one that you
was
missed.
Their response on that?
The other one that you missed is also the one on dumping into the townships, etc.
Do you have those questions? Still remember them? You noted them. Any response?
The issue of repeat offenders is usually the tribunal doesn't, it can impose a maximum penalty of 10%, but it never really does when it's a first-time offender. And we take that into account also when we do our own settlement. So the disincentive for repeat offenders is you're likely to get higher fines. In fact, you are likely to get a maximum fine for a repeat offense. But again, it goes back to the issue of fines being adequate or not. We think that in that situation, the real disincentive for repeat offense is the damages that people should be able to claim against the companies. There is no example of damages that have been claimed in South Africa. Maybe that's why this area is not being fully explored. I think it can really be a disincentive where if companies know that the damages suffered could be recovered. But what's been raised as an issue, and it's been raised again here, is that consumers have really no power, there's no resources to claim these damages. These are some of the things that I think we must start talking about. Did I cover? The dumping in townships is a difficult one, and I think that a lot of those issues will be consumer issues, for example, issues relating to expiry dates for food items and so on. That won't fall squarely within our mandate.
I agree. I maybe need to look at the Consumer Act also and see whether we can call them. Okay. You wanted to come in again?
I just want to say two things. On the damages thing, I think that, you know, maybe there's a lot of assumptions we've made in constructing our laws that are not necessarily applicable here. But I think, you know, like elsewhere in the world, in the United States, for example, you have a much more litigious society. There's more class action. These are things that are not part of our legal culture, and there is a problem around that. I mean, I think there's a bigger problem. The bigger problem is, I think, that poor people find it difficult to get access to justice in any area of the law. You know, you need a lot of money to pay lawyers to get to get access, leave aside winning a case, to the law. So I think that's an issue for us. I'm making this point because the other question we didn't answer was a question from yourself, Chair, about higher litigation costs. And I was saying earlier that, you know, a lot of the work we're doing now is moving along that grid we had from the investigation to the litigation stage. And in the investigation stage, we do in-house a lot of the investigations ourselves. We might hire a consultant to analyze a particular data set now and then, but a lot of that's done by ourselves. When it comes to litigation, we've got to hire lawyers at the market going rate. You know, you can't ask a senior counsel to tender for a job. Their rules don't allow you them to tender. You've got to pay them what their rules say you've got to pay them. And you've got to use a counsel in the court. You can't send one of your junior employees to argue before a court. There's a whole lot of ritual around that that we have to comply by. And I think that increasingly, the more and more cases we send to courts, the higher our legal bill is going to be. And we're seeing an upsurge of that in the last 2 years. Quite frankly, I mean, that's when a lot of the work is starting to move along the chain. So that's to answer your question. We're going to have to we put a lot of effort in our organization to train our people in-house to become, you know, like for example at the tribunal, we on a smaller case we can send our own people to argue, but we can't do that when it goes to the Competition Appeal Court or the High Court. So in the majority of cases of the tribunal, we have our own staff appearing.
Litigation against
you? This is litigation against all the firms that they have been accused or referred to the tribunal for anti-competitive behavior of one sort or the other.
All right. No, thank you. I think we did get the point. And I think this was very necessary, this progress report. And I think what is emphasized here is the need to focus on the consumer and also on the previously disadvantaged or any other person who wants to participate in the economy. So your slogan must now find some breathing in so that you are able to live that. That's what you are saying. And I think the other issue is around partnering with other role players that are really doing more or less the type of work that you're doing, or role players that might support the work that you're doing. Very important. I think that is what really came out very clearly in the meeting. The other issue is around strengthening your own self so that you can then do your work better and make a better impact, you know, in the society at large. So that's also one of the important issues that came up here. I think loosening up a bit, you seem to be confining yourself too much and sometimes losing, you know, even some, you know, of your own responsibilities. And I think if you can do that a bit, it will help you. It will help you a lot to achieve even more than you are achieving. We did indicate also that we are appreciating the work that you are doing. But the people are really eager to see more. Because if I pay 10 rands for a loaf of bread now, when 2 years back I used to pay 5 rands, then it's hitting hard. And with the economic crisis that you're trying to respond to now, with this particular issue, because you were doing your work before, but the pace was too slow. And now with this framework agreement, we want to ensure that you push yourself to the limit so that you can even increase your pace. But from what you are saying, it looks like you are going to be continuing with that snail's pace, and I'm worried about that. I don't get a sense that you are really going to push harder. You are stating more prohibitive factors more than, you know, the opportunity for you to move on. What is there for you to help you move on? I might be wrong in what I've sensed, but that's from your responses. This is, you seem to be too relaxed, and you seem to be concentrating too much on what is more of a barrier than of what is an opportunity. I'm not saying this for you to respond. I've given you more time to respond. I'm now summarizing. And this is just an appeal for you, really, to ensure that you go back, re-strategize, strengthen yourself, make sure that you are even more geared, because there's a lot of work that is coming your way now. And you know you have a lot on your plate now. And we want to see you excelling more than what you're doing now. That, I think, was a way of concluding. We wanted to finish, actually, at quarter to. I made a mistake when we started to say at 12 o'clock because we must give members an opportunity to stretch and all those who are smoking to have a smoking break. Let's then use this opportunity, hoping that this is just the beginning and we'll still engage more, because our role is to ensure that we see you doing what you are assigned to do. We will be pushing you even more, much more harder, so until we are satisfied that people out there get what they are supposed to be getting. I'm not going to allow you, Mr. Ramrush. You want to say thank you? I thought you'd use that opportunity, but you missed the opportunity.
Chair, I want to say thank you very much for this meeting, and the debate has been really very good, Chair. I'm happy to follow up on a presentation, our strategic plan. We do need to talk about the resources issue, and I take it I can refer the dairy cartel to you if there's any questions from then going forward. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, and the members, we will remain. Can we have just a 10-minute stretch break? And otherwise, thank you very much, and to trust you. Thanks to the media, too. Thank you. Can we request the media to assist you in informing the public about their rights? I think that came out very clearly from you. Make sure that they know their rights, that they have a right to claim, you know, for the damages caused by this price-fixing issue.
But, Chairperson, if next time commission come later, we also charge it the farmers.
Come again?
I say if next time, next meeting, they come in later, we also charge the farmers.
We find them.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I agree.
I'm going to time. We also done. I'm 6 years old.
I'm still young.
Thank you. Yeah.